The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 147.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's live stream. I am right here talking to you from Phoenix, Arizona. I'm back at my old stomping ground in the United States. I've been here for a couple weeks now, going to be here for a couple months. Went out to dinner last night with some friends, had a wonderful time catching up with some old acquaintances, and can't wait to get into the questions today. I've been working on a video for kind of a promotional video where I'm going over my three, I'm going to read it right off the whiteboard here, my three bulletproof investment strategies for 2020. What do you think about that one? Pretty good, pretty good. It's an extensive deep dive where I go into, I'll give you a hint. The first strategy is, well, I'm not going to tell you. There's three strategies that we go into. You guys are going to love it. Won't be on the YouTube channel. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag where you'll be able to find it, but it's going to be free. So look forward to that in the near future. And if you guys haven't checked out Rebel Capitalist Pro, definitely do so. This past week, I had live stream Q&As for the members with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. They were absolutely amazing. Lynn was fantastic as always, and Chris was coming to us from Portugal. He's in the kind of European Union right now, scouting out places where he thinks capital is going to move in the future. So a lot of macro stuff going on in Rebel Capitalist Pro. You can check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. But let's dive right into your questions today. Let me go to the top of the list. See what we got. And Bond, James Bond. The question is, you never told us what car you rented. Oh, yeah, I guess we did go over that last week, didn't we? You got us all wound up, didn't give the answer, said 500 horsepower. Yeah, so I didn't, actually, this kind of pertains to investing. So I didn't rent a car, I bought a car. And even if I'm going to be here just a couple months, why did I do that? Because those of you who know and have watched my channel since the very beginning know that way, way, way back in the day, I used to have a side hustle where I would flip trucks. So not just any trucks. I would flip 1995 to 2002 Fords, more specifically the 7.5 liter 460s or the 7.3 liter Power Stroke diesels. And I'd get them under 100,000 miles, no rust, clean Carfax. And I'd buy them locally on Craigslist, locally, you know, not necessarily here in Arizona, but Arizona, Nevada, any no rust state. But I'd buy them locally and then I'd sell them on eBay to a national buyer. And you make a lot of money. I mean, relatively, not an astronomical amount, but for most people, you make 20, 30, 40 grand a month. And so, for most people, that's life changing. For anyone, that's a lot of money for sure. So anyway, I really was into these trucks. And so since I learned how to do that now, or since then, when I've bought any car, I like can't buy a car just to buy it, just to like drive it. Like the only way I can buy a car now is if I can actually make money on it. So yes, the car I bought is a car that I was thinking about buying and I enjoy, but I wouldn't have bought it if I wouldn't have thought I could make money on it. So I think the lesson there and the takeaway is that most people, they buy a car, it's a depreciating asset, and they just get their butt handed to them because they lease it or that's for some people, that might be a better plan. But if you know what you're doing, and if you learn the game of just buying cheap and selling expensive, regardless of whether it's a house, a stock, a bond, or a car, you can drive a car for 6 months or a year, sell it, and actually make money, or even have a net wash so you drive your car for free. It's all about just being educated and knowing what you're doing and understanding how to make money on the buy side. just like real estate, just like the real estate that I've been investing in since 2012, whether it's in the United States or outside the United States. So that's the lesson there for the car. Now, more towards your specific question, what is the car? It's just a Mercedes GTS. It's the AMG GTS. It's a white one. It's got black and white interior. I kind of thought that was interesting, the black and white interior, but that's what it is. Mercedes AMG GTS. Okay. Kenny, what is your opinion on purchasing Bitcoin? Do you own it and why? I have $2,500 worth, but only for reasons of missing out. Okay. I don't know if that's a good reason to buy it though. CEO Slayer, crazy for putting $450 million into it. Well, I mean, it depends on what the size of your portfolio is. If you have a $4.5 billion portfolio, then that might not be crazy. But I think you have to understand why you're buying Bitcoin first and foremost. And if you're buying it just out of FOMO, then I wouldn't buy anything out of FOMO. I think you got to look at it as a solid speculation. But for my portfolio, I just want maybe, 10% of my entire portfolio allocated to a speculative asset class. Therefore, maybe 1-2% into Bitcoin, maybe 5%. I think one of the problems with Bitcoin is that you're going to have a lot of volatility. And I don't know that most people can stomach that type of volatility unless it's a small position in their portfolio. I think long term, Bitcoin has got a lot of tailwind, but there's just going to be a lot of roller coaster ride. And the reason I think that is because I do think the price is manipulated. That's the only way to say it, I guess. I'll try to think of a nice way to say that, but it's just, the price is manipulated. It is. And so I'm not going to go into why I believe that, but I do. So, but that doesn't mean that I'm not a long-term bull. It's just that just makes a lot of noise with the price going up and down, 12,000, 10,000, 9,000, 13,000, blah, 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 blah. But but my point is, see, most people can't stomach that volatility because they think of all of these fundamental reasons why Bitcoin goes up. So if Bitcoin goes down by $3,000 or $4,000, then they think that fundamental reason might be broken, when really it's not. It's still in place. It's just the price is being manipulated so much. So hopefully that answers your question. I mean, my opinion on purchasing Bitcoin is understand why you're investing in Bitcoin or why you're speculating in Bitcoin, and make sure that it's not too big of a portion of your portfolio to where you get emotionally involved or emotionally attached to the price going up or down. If you're emotionally attached to the price of anything you own going up or down, you probably own too much of it. Okay, another question from Bond James Bond. When you're going to be in Vegas again? I'm not sure. Probably sometime maybe around Halloween. I've got to do a speaking engagement next week at the, I think it's called the Red Pill Conference. If you guys haven't, definitely check it out because you can see me live there if you're out in the East Coast or if you're around Georgia or Florida. It's the, let me make sure I'm plugging it right. That's the least I can do. They're nice enough to invite me to speak and fly me out there and everything. So let me give them a quick plug here. A quick plug here. Okay, so it's the Red Pill Expo, and their website is redpillexpo.org. And it's the gentleman that puts it on is the gentleman that wrote the book, or from what I'm understanding. It's just my assistant set this up for me. She's been going back and forth with the people who manage the event. And it's the gentleman that wrote the book on the Fed. Was it G. Edward Griffith? I believe is his name. I'm trying to find it here, but it's not on this website. But you can check it out. I'll be there. I think I'm speaking on Saturday at like 5:00. That's Saturday, October 10th. So you can see me out there. I think Hartman actually might go up there with me. I think Hartman might meet me out there. So you can say hi to me and Jason Hartman out there, ask him a real estate question or two. But yeah, check it out. If you guys are in the area or on the East Coast, it should be a lot of fun. So, and just again, that website was redpillexpo.org. But so probably sometime around Halloween, I'll be in Vegas. And I've been talking to Mark Moss about doing a meetup for the YouTube subscribers and like combining his channel and my channel and him, either me going to SoCal or him coming out to Phoenix or Vegas and us doing like a combined meetup. And I think the restrictions are a little bit looser in Phoenix. So we actually might do one there, but definitely stay tuned. Well, I'm planning on doing that this time or this trip in the United States for sure. Whether it's going to be in Vegas, Phoenix or SoCal, I'm not sure. Okay. Favorite beer. I can't get into that too much, man. I am still light. Okay. What do you think about property managers? I don't like property managers. I want to buy a few apartments, but don't have the time to manage the properties. Yeah, Patrick, that's the biggest problem. And just in all honesty, I'm very close to selling my properties in Kansas City. I started selling them a couple years ago because, again, we got to buy cheap and sell expensive. And so when I started to see that things were getting expensive again, I started to sell. But I still do own a few properties there. And I'm just kind of had it up to here, you know, with the property manager. And so I'm just like, you know, it's just not worth my time. If I had more time, if I wasn't doing the YouTube channel, and if I wasn't, you know, helping out family members and doing these things, I would self-manage. And even if I was in Columbia, I'd still self-manage in Kansas City. It's totally doable. In fact, Hartman, you know, he owns tons of properties and he self-manages almost all of them. And he has this investor network, not just with his business, but outside of that, where they kind of all refer each other to different handyman and electricians and stuff that can just handle the maintenance stuff real quick. And they kind of eliminate the need for that property manager. And he's had a lot of success doing that. So I honestly think that's the way properties work the best. And you don't have to have a lot of time. Just maybe a few hours a month is all, as long as you're doing a good inspection on the property up front. And that might be why maybe in the next downturn, when you guys consider real estate, maybe look at buying a house that's a little newer and therefore you wouldn't have the maintenance issues. If you don't have the maintenance issues, it's just about collecting rent. And as long as you got the right tenant, well, let me say that a different way. As long as you got the right property in the right neighborhood that attracts the right tenant, self-management is not a big deal. It's really not. It's just when you're dealing with these property managers that they just, I think right now, in all honesty, because of COVID, the property managers have taken a big hit. And that is a terrible business, even without COVID. They just can't make money. The only way they can make money is if they do a poor job, if they give poor service to the actual tenants, or they rip you off. That's the only way they can make money. That's their business model. And I don't think anyone goes into the business with malicious intent. I think they go into the business thinking they can make money and they just don't, they haven't worked the numbers. And then once they go in and start the business and start taking on all these properties and lease out an office and employees, then all of a sudden they look around at their QuickBooks and their P&L and like, whoa, wait a minute here. We can't make money. Like this is, we can't, even if we scale it, the more we scale it, the more money we lose. And then they get themselves between a rock and a hard place where they try to use all this technology. Oh, we got these iPads, or we got this new technology that'll allow us to do this, to where we have a tenant portal, or they don't have to talk to, you know, human beings, and they could just schedule their own maintenance and blah, 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 blah. Listen, I've been in real estate since 2012. I have heard that, I don't want to call it BS, but I've heard that sales pitch over and over and over and over and over and over again, where there's always a new technology that's going to revolutionize the property management business. But at the end of the day, it's a people business. It's just, it's a face-to-face people on the phone collecting rent, marketing the property, having subcontractors go out there and do the maintenance. You can't turn that into an app, you know? You can't Uberize, you can't Amazon a property management company. It is what it is. It's the same thing 100 years ago, and 100 years from now, it's going to be the same business. And it's going to be a crappy business 100 years from now as well. Now, don't get me wrong. There are definitely property managers out there that are fantastic and that are awesome. But they're far and few between. And you got to kiss a lot of frogs. And right now, with as much as I have going on, I just don't have time to kiss any frogs. And so that's why I'm kind of thinking about selling those properties. But that was a long-winded answer. I've got way off on a tangent there. But that's what I think of property managers. You got a thorough answer right there, Patrick. So I would try to self-manage, but I wouldn't deter that. I wouldn't allow that to deter you from buying properties if you can get them at the right price. Remember, it's you got to buy things when they're cheap. If you can get them at the right price, whether it's a good price for the cash flow, good price for the debt, or a combination of all three things, then, you know, don't let the property management deter you. But do take it into consideration. Know that optimal situation is you managing it yourself. And then if you have to find a property manager, it's just going to take you some time. It's doable, but it's going to take you time. And you'll have a great one for 3 years, and then they'll start to suck. You'll have to fire them, and you'll have to kiss frogs for another 6 months to get another one in there. So that's the downside to rental properties. Would I consider the footsie cheap enough to buy? It's back to the same level as it was in 1998 and yielding 3.7%. Maybe. I don't. That's a good question. I haven't looked at the footsie. Maybe I should. I mean, I don't like the direction that the government's going, that's for sure, because they're on this Marxist push just like the United States. But, and there are heavy financials too. But if it's cheap, it's cheap. Well, I guess to answer your question directly, would I consider it? Yeah, sure, I'd consider it. I'm agnostic when it comes to buying assets. But I haven't looked into it. But I definitely will, because now that you've said it's at the same level it was in 1998, you've definitely sparked my interest. So I'll check that out. Thank you for the recommendation. Okay, next question. Globally, where do you see a good place to sit things out with my family over the coming 6 months to a year? Love your show. Thank you so much for the channel and the foresight. Sure. Thanks for the kind words. There's no better place to sit out volatility from a social standpoint than St. Bart's. I can tell you that right now. Because every single person on the entire island is a billionaire. So there's no, trust me, you're not going to see a riot in St. Bart's. You're not going to see any social unrest in St. Bart's. That is for sure. Now, whether or not you can afford to stay there, that's another question, because it's the cost of living is astronomical. But if that's your main concern, is just keeping your family safe, and just being in a very positive environment, and in an environment that doesn't have a lot of lockdown regulations, and you don't have to wear masks everywhere. And I don't know that they've had a COVID case since April. So it's almost completely stress-free. So if you've got the resources at your disposal, I would start there for sure. Outside of, let's see, I mean, it looks like you're kind of worried about the COVID thing, and I'm kind of guessing that, and the social unrest element. I mean, I might look at Japan, if that's what your concern was. If you wanted like really kind of nice and modern, I might look at Japan, maybe Sweden. I know they didn't take a lot of steps with the whole lockdown thing. But Japan might have, but you're sure you're not going to see social unrest in Japan. I would probably look at Dubai. Personally, I would look at Dubai because it takes the social unrest out of the equation. At least you're not going to see any Antifa in Dubai. I can tell you that. But I kind of like Dubai because although they might have a couple of restrictions with COVID, I'm very bullish on Dubai long term, as a lot of you might know. And the real estate there is getting real cheap, like super cheap. And so I would kind of see that as like a double whammy opportunity, where I could go someplace and kind of get my family in an area that I didn't really have to worry about riots and looting. And then I could go to a place where longer term I'm bullish, and then I could start doing homework and start kicking tires on the real estate market there. Or maybe, you know, stocks or maybe bonds or anything like that. Just start kicking tires with investment opportunities, while at the same time it's checking those boxes that you have for the family things that you've mentioned. So I'd look at Dubai probably. Yeah, those are the places that I'd start. That's kind of, you can hear my thought process, and that's how I'd look at any country, whether it was Dubai, Japan, Sweden, Georgia, not the state, but the country. I might look there too. Montenegro, I'd probably look. Saudi Arabia. Well, I probably wouldn't go there now. That's more of a long-term play. Yeah, I'd start with those countries I mentioned.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Could cryptocurrencies be affected by power shortages and blackouts? Mark Moss is bearish power grid, but very bullish Bitcoin. Would less power affect mining exchanges? Yeah, but I mean, I don't want to put words in Mark's mouth, but I would assume that Mark is more bearish on the power grid in California because it's a effing disaster, which is, I was talking to him on the phone the other day, and he's like, yeah, the mayor comes out at like 3 o'clock every day and asks people to cut back on their electricity use. While at the same time, Gavin Newsom is coming out and saying that every car in California is going to be electric by 2035. You're like, okay, so how do you connect those dots? So how are we going to get to an all electric vehicle state when the state currently doesn't produce enough electricity for us to even turn the lights on all day? And that's during COVID. Just think if we didn't have COVID and the economy was at the same pace or running at the same pace it was back in, call it January or December, then they'd have to turn out the lights at like 10 a.m. in the morning. They wouldn't have any electricity in California. So again, I don't want to put words in Mark's mouth. He's obviously a great guy, a smart guy, but I'm guessing he's kind of more bearish the power grid just in California. And then, you know, obviously Bitcoin doesn't pertain exclusively to California, so that's why he's more bullish there. I totally get his long-term bullish view on Bitcoin. I'm in the same camp. But like I said earlier, I see it having quite a bit of volatility there that unfortunately I think will shake out a lot of people. Arthur, what's up, buddy? I'll see you here in the Rebel Capitalist Pro live stream in about, what, an hour and a half or so. Eric, same thing, buddy. I'll see you there. Question, what are your thoughts on the quantum financial system that some are talking about that is to usher a new world digital dollar currency that is backed by gold and has fixed quantity? When did I do? Oh, you know what? I did a video. It was, I don't know if you guys watched my video Thursday night, but it got so long that I had to stop it because my editors just couldn't finish it by the time we were supposed to upload it. So I could only do steps one and two. And step three, I actually talk about this exactly. So not about the quantum financial system exactly, but I talk about a digital currency that was a fixed quantity digital currency that was the new monetary system and what the pros and cons would be. And there are cons. There are definitely cons there. You're not going to be able to expand the money supply at a rate which would be optimal for economic growth, assuming we're in the same economic environment that we were in the late 1800s, where you had very little regulation, very little government, very low taxes. If we could somehow wave a magic wand to get back to that area, then you would have suboptimal growth. Short term, that's key. And that's what I went over. That's one of the things I went over in the video, is I think long term, you'd have the same amount of growth, but it would just be more slow, more gradual, where if you allow the money supply to expand, let's say you've got a fractional reserve system that's tied to this digital dollar that has a fixed quantity, then you're allowing for the money supply to expand. But I think if you allow for the money supply to expand, you're going to have a boom bust cycle. It's just a matter of how big is the boom and how big is the bust. And it goes back to Hazlitt. I reference Henry Hazlitt, a paper that he wrote for Mises, for Mises.org, or at least it was a paper that was published on Mises.org from 1979, where Hazlitt talks about the exact same things we're talking about today. But instead of a crypto-backed or a digital-backed or a digital currency, he's talking about a currency that's backed 100% by gold, to where there is no fractional reserve. There is no expansion of the money supply at all. The only way you can get a loan is if someone literally loans you the dollars. There are no new dollars created. And he goes through this thought experiment of the pros and cons, which is another thing that I address in that video. And I think that obviously the benefit to the fractional reserve system is it can expand, and it can expand with the economy or the needs of the economy. But you just go boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. And gradually it goes up and up and up. But without the fractional reserve system, I think you get to the same place just in a more linear fashion. And Hazlitt's argument was the problem with the fractional reserve system, that it leading to these booms and busts, wasn't necessarily that it leads to the booms and busts, but over time, these booms and busts get bigger. And the socialists and the communists blame these booms and busts on capitalism. Sound familiar? Sounds very familiar to me. And the interesting thing is, this was something that was written by Hazlitt back in 1979. And we see it playing out today, right in front of our eyes. So there's pros and cons there, but I don't know. You'll have to watch my video to see the conclusion. We'll leave it at that. Question: Chris Cole's Dragon portfolio is slightly different from GG's 10-80-10, is what I call it. Thoughts on 19% gold allocation versus your 10%, also substituting real estate for fixed income due to low yields? Yeah, so this is another project. I'm working on this one on the whiteboard this morning, and I'm going to try to get that done this week, where I walk you through my three bulletproof investment strategies for 2020. But another video that we have to complement this one is a video where I actually invest $100,000 of my own money. And we just start right at the beginning with me opening up a brand new account with Interactive Broker, and then putting $100,000 in the account. And not that I'd use the entire 100 to buy stocks, but we'd start the account with 100 grand, and it would be my money. And I'll show you my bank statement to prove that it's my 100,000 going into the account. And then I do like kind of an over the shoulder thing, so you guys could watch every single thing that I do, from setting up the account. You press this button, you go to this button, you have to fill out this paperwork. I'm having my assistant fill out the paperwork for Interactive Brokers. Bam, we've got our account set up. So whether you're a newbie or you're a pro, you know, we'll break it down into sections. So the pros might not want to watch me setting up an IB account. But for the noobs, you know, they can watch this and say, oh, I see. You literally click on, you go to the internet, Interactive Brokers account. You click on this button. Then you click on this button. Then you click on that button. Bam, now you got your account. Here's how to fund it. You do bam, 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 bam. And then once we get done with that, then we get to the fun part. And that's doing the research and trying to figure out what's cheap and what's expensive. And obviously, you guys know me, I'm not going to stick to just the United States. I'm going to be looking all over the world for opportunities. And then we're going to do the 10-80-10. I'm going to try to, you know, stick with that. And then what I'm going to do maybe with a separate portfolio, and I might do like 50 grand for my portfolio. I was going to do another 50 grand and try to do something like the Dragon portfolio. And then we can kind of track the two. And with the Dragon portfolio, I wanted to at least do something with that, because I think that that's a lot easier for people with a 401k or with this IRA. You know, so many people comment and they say, George, I've got a 401k. I can only invest in these three funds. And they're all just a matter of what type of stock do you want? Do you want a value fund? Do you want a growth fund or whatever? Do you want a bond fund? That's pretty much it. And so I was thinking, I'm like, you know what? If I had a 401k and that's the only thing that I could invest in, I would probably try to replicate a Dragon portfolio. So with the 401k part of the portfolio, I would buy the stocks and the bonds, and then, or the funds, whatever. And then I'd hopefully they'd allow you to buy gold, or maybe I'd buy Sprott. I'd buy Rick's deal. So I'd buy PHYS to have exposure to physical through the 401k. And then I'm just down to commodity trend and volatility. And I think what I'd probably do is take obviously money that maybe would have gone into my 401k, take that out and have that on the side. And so I'd have my 401k managing the part of the Dragon portfolio that was allocated to bond, stocks, and gold. And then with the commodity trend and the long volatility, I would manage that with my own money outside of the 401k. So then you're able to kind of get that type of exposure. And I think that if you've got a 401k, I think that's what I would do personally. So with this $100,000 that I'm going to invest, and I'm going to do that so you guys can watch every single step I take and what companies I buy and all this stuff. And then I'm going to explain, of course, my rationale. You're going to see where I'm doing the research. Most likely going to be Rebel Capitalist Pro. And you're going to just watch me from A to Z. And so I think I'm just thinking it through, but I'll probably do 50 grand of the 10-80-10 and then 50 grand of the Dragon portfolio or something like that. So anyway, stay tuned. And again, if you're trying to replicate the Dragon portfolio, and if you're doing it, then I totally get the 19% gold. Yeah. Totally makes sense. How do I determine if the S&P is cheap or expensive? I like the Buffett indicator. And oh, by the way, guys, you want to see, I'll give you some insider information right now that I was going to tweet out, and I totally spaced it. I didn't even know this, but I looked at the market cap to GDP, which is basically the Buffett indicator. And just recently, since the Cerveza sickness, it's the only time in history. See that blue line? That blue line, that indicates market cap. Okay, so basically the stock market. That the green line, that indicates GDP. There, you can barely see it, but in the GFC, the green actually dipped down. So GDP went down. And then, of course, the stock market went down by, what, 50%? Something like that. But right now, in the Cerveza sickness, GDP is plummeting, as we all know, but the stock market's going up. And it sounds crazy to say that out loud, and we've heard it so many times, but look at the chart. Going all the way back to the 1970s, that's never happened, ever, not once. The only time nominal GDP went down during the GFC, the stock market went down by 50%. That's the only time nominal GDP went down, other than now. Now, nominal GDP has gone down by even more, but the stock market hasn't gone down by 50%. It's gone up. So if you're asking me, you know, how I determine if the S&P is cheap or if it's expensive, that's one way right there. If GDP is going in the toilet and the stock market is going straight up, in my opinion, that's means the stock market's expensive. Or just look at the delta. See, look at this. See how the green line almost consistently since the 1970s has been higher than the blue line. That means that nominal GDP is higher than the market cap of the stock market, as it should be, except for just these little points, like right there in the dot-com bust or the dot-com bubble. It peaked up just right before the GFC, same thing. Now, look at the delta. I can't even point. Look at that. Look at how huge the gap is between nominal GDP and the market cap of the stock market. Unbelievable. So anybody that says that the stock market isn't expensive right now, they just don't know what they're talking about. They're living in a fantasy world, and they're just trying to rationalize things. And then the argument that you always hear is that, oh, well, these valuations are justified because interest rates are so low. What are you talking about? That doesn't make any sense. I mean, let's think that through. So on that logic, you should buy Japan because the valuations are even lower in Japan and you have negative yields. So if that's your rationale for something being cheap, you should be buying Japan, not the United States. And then you should be buying Europe before the United States, right? So that doesn't make any sense. And just look at the Buffett indicator, and you don't want to have anything to do with the stock market. Now that said too, there's nuance in that. Because why is market cap so high? Because the breadth is so narrow that market cap is being driven by like just a handful of stocks that are just worth trillions of dollars now. So there can be opportunities within the stock market. There might be cheap stocks, but as a whole, it's just wildly overpriced. But that might be due to just a few stocks, maybe 10 or 12. So there's a lot of nuance in there, to say the least. But just from a macro standpoint, that's how I determine, just by looking at it quickly, if the stock market is cheap or if it's expensive. And when that green line, again, gets above the blue line, that's when I want to be a buyer of the S&P. You know, I'm not a hater against the U.S. stock market. I'm totally agnostic. I just want to buy things when they're cheap. And I don't care what it is. If it's cheap, I'm interested. Mike is asking, what is a good storable commodity that doesn't spoil other than metals? Trucks. And I know that just sounds so ridiculous for me to say that, but it's the honest truth. It's just the honest truth. When I got involved with the side hustle there, I knew macro, but nothing to the extent that I know today. But I fortunately kept several of those trucks in storage, and I still have them today. And I haven't really checked my prices because I don't really care. I just keep them as a store of value, just like gold. And I looked at the prices the other day. So how do I look at the prices? I go on eBay and I look at the sold listings. Not the ones that are just for sale, the ones that actually sold. And that's how I kind of do comps, if you will, just like doing comps in real estate. And the prices have gone through the roof. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because those were, in my opinion, the best trucks ever made. And good luck finding one with no rust and under 100,000 miles. And the more people drive them, the fewer of those trucks exist that have that type of mileage. So you've got an asset, and one of the very few assets I can think of that actually the supply of the asset over time gets lower and lower and lower and lower. I don't know another asset class that does that. Not right off the top of my head. Not even fine art, because the amount of art, unless someone steals it or just loses it or whatever, the amount doesn't go down over time. Like, there's no fewer Monets today than there was 2 years ago, but there's a lot fewer Ford 1995 7.3 Power Strokes under 100,000 miles today than there was 2 years ago. I can tell you that. So I know it sounds corny, but I think that's a great store of value. And the prices have gone up so much. And again, it makes sense because they're so rare. They're only getting more rare. And because of the Cerveza sickness, everyone's out there buying an RV. And what do you want to buy to tow your RV? Do you want to buy some brand new $80,000 truck it's going to cost you $1,000 to change the oil? Or do you want to buy a 1995 Ford that you could swim in the engine bay? You could go in there, you could put your hand in there, you could change the oil for $5. You can do any work on that you want, maybe not on the Power Stroke, but on the 460. I mean, and not only that, but especially the 2002, you know, once you got to the 99 body style with the 7.3s, those are pretty modern body styles. And they had great power, easy can tow an RV, even like a 34-foot Airstream or something, you could tow with that. And you can get it at a fraction of the price, even though prices have gone up. So for me, that's a no-brainer. Buying a 7.3 with 100,000 miles, that engine, you know, as well as I do, that engine will go 700,000 miles easy, if you take care of it. So you're basically buying a brand new truck for $20,000 as opposed to $80,000, and one that's, in my opinion, better, has less over-engineering, and is going to cost you a lot less to maintain. So anyway, long story short, I love gold. You guys know that. I kind of put it in a category all of its own with insurance. But as an outside of the box type thing, you know, what else do I look at? I look at those old diesel trucks and the 460s.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
My favorite ancient civilization? I don't know. I mean, I grew up in, I mean, I'm a Christian and I was brought up that way. So I'm always fascinated by the Jews and, you know, in the Old Testament. So I don't know if that's your question, but that's probably my quick answer. Okay. Dynasty, for a young person, what is the best way to start off as an entrepreneur? Well, I think the best financial decision that you can make is house hack as a young person. So that means buy a triplex, make sure you take out 30-year fixed rate mortgage, have your two tenants pay the mortgage. Hopefully you're after the insurance and everything, the maintenance and whatnot, taxes are paid. Hopefully you're cash flow positive still. That would be ideal. And then you're living rent-free and you're living mortgage-free, rent-free. And then you just take that money that you would have spent on housing and just invest it. That's what I do first and foremost. Then as far as the entrepreneur side of the coin, I would start something online. You know, now that I've done this YouTube channel, and it's not like this YouTube channel it's not like you monetize it that much, but you make a little bit with the ads and with the online forum and stuff. And, but my point is I've done both. I've had a brick and mortar business, many of them. I've had offline businesses and I've had online businesses. And I can tell you that the online businesses just make way, 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 way more sense. I mean, you can start an online business with $300. You can't start you might be able to start an offline business like that, but it would be a heck of a lot harder to scale that offline business. And what's neat is if you can save up like $1,000 or something, then you can start like three different online businesses and just work out all the kinks. You're going to make a ton of mistakes. That's fine. That's how you learn. And I heard someone say one time, and it's very true, the most successful people in life are usually the people who have made the most mistakes. And I think that phrase in and of itself says a lot. And I definitely can put myself in that category. I've made more mistakes than anyone I know. The thing is, I was never afraid to make mistakes because I had, and I still do probably have quite a bit. I've got excessive confidence in my own decision-making. And, and I would say excessive. I would openly admit that I'm probably overconfident in my own decision-making, but it's sometimes it goes against you and sometimes it works in your favor. You know, that TV show I did in Medellin is a perfect example of that. You know, how many people would have the, I don't want to use that language, but I'm trying not to use the language I'd normally use to describe that situation. But, how many people would be willing or even think of starting a TV show in a country where not only you didn't live and you didn't really know the customs, you didn't even speak the language. Like I didn't speak Spanish. And then the show that I pitched to them involved me being one of the cast members and not even speaking Spanish. So how does that work? Most people would create all of these roadblocks, right? They turn molehills into mountains or whatever the saying goes, you know, where as an entrepreneur, you do the complete opposite, right? You see something that is really a huge obstacle. And you're like, oh, easy. I can handle that. No problem. And a lot of times, again, you probably have an excessive amount of confidence in your own ability, but sometimes it works out for the best. So anyway, my point is you'll go through this process. You'll learn the process. You'll make the mistakes. Do it online first. Do it online. And then once you do it, why? Because it's cheaper and it's faster. So you get the schooling and you go through those learning curves in a way that isn't that doesn't damage your net worth too much. And then once you get all the skills and the people skills and the leadership and understand how to negotiate and to run a business and to you understand QuickBooks, you understand accounting, you understand a P&L, a balance sheet, how to do all these things, credit card processing. Then if you've got a great idea for an offline business, go ahead and start the offline business because you'll have all the skills required to ensure that you've got the greatest chance of being a success possible. And you're not going to have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in the school of hard knocks with the offline businesses because you've learned those same things in the online businesses for just a couple grand. See, so that's what I would do. Fractional reserve theory of banking or more the credit creation theory of banking from Richard Werner. I see. I think your question is what actually happens in real life in the modern monetary system. Is it more the way that a typical fractional reserve system is outlined in like a textbook, or in reality, does it work more like Richard Werner describes with the credit creation? And the banks create the additional money supply. They don't really lend out existing money. And that's an easy one. Richard Werner's right. Simple. Fractional reserve banking really doesn't exist. And now it's interesting, though. Now, that said, let me throw in something there. If you look at the way it works, or if you look at the balance sheets of the banks, they kind of end up being a net wash. It's so whether you are lending out people's actual money, the it really doesn't affect the balance sheets too much. So you kind of could say that it works in a fractional reserve way. But if you said the banks lend money or lend, if you said the banks lend existing money, that is a false statement. The banks do not lend existing money. When they create a loan, they create additional money supply. So for me to really go into the nuance of what makes those different. And then at the end of the day, how they're pretty much kind of the same, that would take a half an hour whiteboard video. So I can't explain that on a live stream. I'm not that good, but Richard Werner is spot on. And if you want a backup to that, that really explains it well, check out the Bank of England's paper 2014 on money creation. I can't recall the name of it, but if you just Google Bank of England 2014 money creation, the paper will pop right up. Let's see. Do I think the stock market will generally continue to rise because of the Fed buying assets? That's one of those probability questions. I think the best way for me to answer that would be, I do see the Fed buying assets coming in the future. As far as not just assets, because that's kind of pretty much what they're doing now. As far as equities, I do see them buying equities in the future when we get another market downturn, because the more they put all their eggs, as far as their economic eggs, in one basket, and that basket being asset prices. I mean, we're going to get to a point where quite literally almost the entire economy is based on asset prices, and the economy will go up and down with the asset prices themselves. It'll be totally the tail wagging the dog. And we're getting close to that world, in my opinion. And so the Fed won't have a choice but to buy equities or do whatever they can to prop up these asset prices, because if they don't, the real economy will collapse. And so, I mean, they're not going to sit back and say, well, we've done everything we can. Sorry, guys, we're out. We're just going to sit back and watch it from a distance. We're going to get in our 1995 diesel truck and our RV, and we're going to head up to the mountains, and we're just going to watch it all take place. They're not going to do that. They're going to come in, and they're going to come up with all of these operation twists and quantitative easing and this and that, all these, you know, special purpose vehicles and all of the MILF programs and these acronyms that nobody knows yet. They're going to throw everything at it. And I think that includes buying equities. So my point is, I see this providing a lot of tailwind to the market. Does it prop it up? That's a completely different question. We can look at Japan and see that just because the central bank comes in and buys equities through ETFs, it doesn't necessarily mean that the stock market goes up. So at the end of the day, the market's bigger than the Fed. The market's going to call the shots. Sometimes it takes a long time, decades. But at the end of the day, the market will overpower any type of intervention. In my retirement IRA account, if I sell high and buy low again, wash, rinse, repeat. Oh, I see. Yeah, you're going to get hit with the taxes. My sale taxable or not? You got to look, Danny. I've never had an IRA, and I've never had a 401k. So I hate to, I don't know. I don't know. So you got to check with your accountant or someone who has more experience with that than I do. I don't even want to venture a guess, because I'm not the guy to ask that question. Question, the Fed can't bail out the $1 quadrillion notional value of the derivative market? I don't know if I'd ask that question, Mike. I think the question might be, can the Fed bail out the banking system? Because that's who's really holding the bag on that. And yeah, I mean, I guess they can. It's just a matter of, I mean, they can expand their balance sheet infinitely if there's assets. And what if there's no assets? I guess they could buy the derivatives. Then it's just a matter of there's no free lunch. We all know that. So if they expand their balance sheet to a quadrillion, there's got to be a release valve somewhere. And I don't even know what the dollar would be worth if they expanded their balance sheet to a quadrillion. Just because they do doesn't necessarily mean that there's more currency units chasing goods and services. But at that point, I can't imagine how some of that base money wouldn't leak out. But I mean, who knows? I would have said the same thing with the Fed taking their balance sheet from $800 billion to $7 trillion. At the end of the day, we have to realize that there's a transfer mechanism from base money to broad money. And as of right now, that transfer mechanism is the government or the banking system. And if they're not playing ball, then all those bank reserves, whether it's $7 trillion or a quadrillion, just sit at the Fed and do nothing. The only thing they do is expand the balance sheets of the commercial banking system. That doesn't mean that the banking system creates any more loans. And you say, well, you know, they're incentivized. Well, yeah, they might be incentivized, but that doesn't mean that there's anyone in the real economy that wants to take a loan. So many people get fixated on the supply side of lending and they forget the demand side. There's got to be demand. People actually need to want to take out a loan. And yeah, there might always be hedge funds that want to take out loans to buy those financial derivatives or whatever, or create this financial engineering. But I don't know. At a certain point, people's incomes have to be able to service the debt. And people aren't stupid. They're not going to just take on debt just because the banks are throwing it at them. And now some people might, you're going back to the GFC, you could argue that housing was like that, but that wasn't a huge majority of the American population. I don't think that the majority of Americans or any humans, it doesn't have to be Americans, anyone for that matter, would take out debt that they knew there was just no way they could service with their existing income. Again, on the margin, yeah, sure, there's people like that, but it's not 80 or 90% of Americans, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, got one more minute, guys. So let's do another question and we'll call it a day. How bad does it get before it gets better? Well, unfortunately, I think it gets a lot worse, and I don't think it can get better. If you define better by an economy that is structurally sound. So let me preface by saying that. And this goes back to my conversation with Jeff Snyder and Lynn Alden. If you guys watched that interview, it was hugely popular. And that Thursday night whiteboard video is based on that conversation I had with Jeff and Lynn, where I asked Jeff point blank. I said, can we have a recovery in the real economy if we don't fix the monetary system? And his answer was no, no. We do not get a true recovery in the real economy unless the euro-dollar monetary system that we have had since Bretton Woods is fixed, because it collapsed in 2008. It's still broken and it's just sputtering. It's on life support right now. And there's no way to have a proper recovery that would create a fundamentally sound economy without a fundamentally strong monetary system. So I don't know there's a way we can transfer or transition from the euro dollar system into a brand new monetary system without going through some serious pain. I hope there is, but I haven't figured it out yet. And unfortunately, I think what's going to happen is the politicians and the central banks aren't going to acknowledge that the existing system is broken, because they don't understand it. I mean, Snyder and a handful of other people, I would argue, are really just the only people in the world, quite frankly, that understand the global monetary system. And there's no way politicians do. I mean, they don't even know the first thing about it. And I don't think the Powell does. I don't think the Fed does. And so if they don't even understand it, they don't even know it's broken. They're just going to continue to do the same things over and over and over again, but just more of them, expecting different results, the definition of insanity. And as a result, they're going to make the system not only more fragile, but they're going to make it structurally more and more unsound until we get to a point where there's just no turning back and the whole thing is just a house of cards that just completely collapses in on itself, regardless of what the central banks or the politicians do. And I wish they understood the problem so we could try to transition to a new system to avoid some of that downside that we'll have to go through, or we will go through, if they continue to try to kick the can down the road with the existing system, making it worse. But that would require the politicians and the central banks to figure this out. And I don't have any confidence that they'll do that, unfortunately. Okay, I think that's about it for this live stream, guys. I really appreciate it. Got almost 1,000 people, 900. I think we might have got to 1,000 people. I wasn't paying attention today. But I want to just remind everyone to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. We have this trial going with Gene, my digital marketing guy. You can try a week for $1. You cannot beat that anywhere. So go check it out at georgegammon.com/pro. And I want to give some shout outs to people that made it all the way to the end. I'm going to go down and hit the button for new comments. And so we got Phil Soden says, thanks, George. Phil, thank you for staying on all the way to the end. We've got Eric, Mark, Brendan, Arthur. We'll see you in about an hour, buddy. We have BG, Steven, Rigo. Oh, it just bounced around on me. Adden, Elliot, Dab D, Enigma, Jim, Ralph, Andy, K, Mariana, Varying Viewpoint, Stacy, Bill, the Insurance Dudes Podcast. that sounds like a good one. I might check that out. Thanks for being on to the end, guys. Atlas, Ron, Off on a Tangent. That should be the name of my YouTube channel. That should at least be the name of my live streams. That's for sure. Me, Lynn, Rod, Fatal, where'd it go? Fatal 9998. All right, Mike, Kimberly. Awesome, guys. We appreciate another live stream. I love it. And I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.